The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
So welcome to the Free Library. My name is Michelle Sheffer. I'm the staff writer for the Free Library Foundation. If you aren't already, I would love to encourage you to become our fan on Facebook and follow our Free Library Twitter feed. It's a great way to keep up with what's going on here and also plenty of fun facts from the world of information. So please do so. It is such a pleasure to be introducing Josh Ritter tonight. Like I'm sure all of you, I'm such a huge fan of his music, and I was absolutely thrilled when I heard that he would be writing a novel. And as soon as I heard that, I began pestering Andy, who runs the author events program, to please, please, please bring him. Josh's music evokes a plethora of very quite warranted comparisons to singer-songwriter legends like Bob Dylan and Leonard Cohen. But at the same time, he maintains such a unique and refreshing voice among the current music scene. If you're a fan of the lyricism and the clever storytelling found in his music, his first novel will absolutely not disappoint. On Twitter recently, someone actually described how reading Bright's passage is like walking through a museum of sentences, which I thought was a very lovely and very apt description. Josh will be interviewed on stage tonight by David Dye. He's the founder and host of XPN's awesome World Cafe program. David was an early champion of Josh's work, so it seems especially fitting to have both of them here with us tonight. I'm so excited. Okay. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Josh Ritter.
Awesome. Rachel doted on that mangy old horse. She shook out tart wild apples, brought up thistles and fistfuls of stinging nettles and mint from downstream where the ground turned marshy. As September oranged into October and such treats became harder to find, she would harry Bright for bags of sweet dried corn when he went to town so that she might hold handfuls of it lovingly under the horse's greedy snout. Sometimes, in the wood smoke blue mornings, he would watch her leaning against its warm flank, one arm thrown up and across its withers, whispering into its ear as she ran his mother's ivory comb through the animal's forelock. Despite all the girl's attentions, however, the horse's thickening pelt took on a shagged and greasy appearance that, along with its baleful gaze and consumptive ribs, made it look like some moss-covered mule wandered in from a fairy tale. "She spoils you, and I don't know what for," he said to the back of the horse's head one early morning after the first frost. "I don't know what kind of hold you got on her." Horse and man were on the road to Fell's Corner for supplies. "And don't pretend you don't hear me, because I know you hear me," he twitched the reins. "Henry Bright, you have a beautiful wife." "I know it. I married her, didn't I?" "No need to sound so jealous. I helped you. It's only right you should share her with me." "Help nothing," Bright laughed. "I had to drag you inside that goddamn house, remember? If you were going to steal her and marry her on your own, you could have done it the minute you thought of it and with my blessing too, but you couldn't, could you? You don't even have no hands. What if there was a doorknob or something?" "Henry Bright, keep it. I'm telling you, whatever sweet-talking you're doing to my wife, to quit it. She don't need those kind of distractions right now. We're going to have a baby." "So the child has been conceived." "That's what I said, isn't it? Quit whatever other mischief you got on your mind for and remember the promise that you made to me." "Which was?" "Which was you were going to keep her and the baby safe from the colonel and his boys like you done for me in the war. Remember when you said all that? That you'd protect us and the future king of heaven and all that?" "When did it happen?" "What?" "When was the child conceived?" What the hell does that matter? It got conceived, didn't it? Don't try to change the subject. You going to keep your promise to me or what? We've done well. What do you mean, we? The angel said nothing but clomped along thoughtfully. Angel? Bright snapped the reins again. Angel, what do you mean by we? You ain't done nothing yet. Angel? Angel? Receiving no answer, he sprang from the saddle and stood in the horse's path, bringing it to a halt before him. I'd hit a horse, he said. You probably think I wouldn't, but I would.
Awesome. Thank you.
The first World War was a moment that I was really interested in. I always thought that the best thing about being a writer of any kind was the chance to read whatever you were into and never have to make apologies, you know, and just to follow your interests whether they make any sense at the time or not. And for a long time as a musician, I have been doing this thing which I encourage everyone to try. When you go to a hotel and you go into the lobby and you see the fireplace there that's filled with the big screen TV and there's the ball, the bowl of those kind of like twiny balls that sort of are in there just to fill up spaces, and then you see on either side of the TV, which is always playing Glenn Beck, There's always a shelf of books around it to make it look, you know, homey and livable. And they're not doing anything there. They're just hanging out. And I just think you should steal them, you know. I take them. And you can get great stuff. You know, I this book wouldn't have happened without a book that I stole called The Proud Tower by Barbara Tuchman, which has a very plain cover. And looks good on a shelf next to Glenn Beck, but it's a fantastic book. It's a book about the 25 years leading up to the eve of the First World War. And there's the First World War happened at this crest of time, it seems to me, when everybody thought they had everything figured out. We had a notion of time. We had a notion of human psychology. We had advanced scientifically to the point that we couldn't go any farther. You know, people wondering, the only thing that was left was to colonize Mars, you know? And then the First World War happened and shattered everything, and followed by all these other enormous advances and retreats in human history, in the human condition, I'd say. And so I was really interested in that, and at the same time I was really interested and became really interested in angels, maybe not the physical angel, but the idea of them, you know, that we have in our mythology and in our religion, we have these creatures that come down and tell us what to do with absolute conviction, you know, and they're strange and weird, but they always seem to tell us exactly what to do, and that very rarely works out, you know. You've got the angel of death, you know, the most overworked angel. And then you have, you know, the angels in the sky that fill the sky and say there's a new baby being born and he will be the king of heaven. Or coming to Mary and saying, guess what? You're pregnant. Things are about to change. And they always say, fear not, which I think is almost the long-running joke in the Bible. It's like angels showing up and saying, it's cool. So I had been really interested in angels, and I was writing this book, and I finished it, and I realized that so many of my songs had been about angels all along, and that I'd been really working on that idea for a long time. Angels seem to be the thing that tells you that everything is okay, and that everything is right in heaven when everything seems to be absolutely running contrary to that, and that we never question the angel.
is interesting. So I wanted to work a lot on that, and it's been a lot of fun. And I'd like to read one more quick passage, if that's cool. All right, cool. By May, Rachel's belly was big, and they were happy. At night, he would hold her close, and she would tell him wild stories that came from her own mind. She never talked about her father and brothers. It was as if, since her rescue, they had ceased to exist for her. And if that was so, he saw no need to remind her of them or of the awful threats the old man had made as they turned their back on him and rode away together. Sometimes he would tell her about the war, but when he did, it was always about the little things. The finding once of a lemon, or the unlikely discovery of a bottle of clear liquor standing untouched in an exploded bar. The thick white towels at the hotel where he had stayed during his leave from the front. He never told her about the church or the angel. And if he ever got too close to those things, he would stop mid-sentence. And she, sensing something in him, would help him to steer his stories until the tension in his voice was gone and the pounding in his chest had slowed. And where were you then? And Sam Mihiel. That's a pretty name. Sam Mihiel. Yeah. We were in a graveyard. In a graveyard? What were you doing in a graveyard? We were all on our hands and knees, and the one guy next to me, Ezra, he froze because he saw a gravestone with his last name on it. What was his last name? Her fingertips stroked at the hair on his chest. I don't remember what it was. Ezra something or other. He saw it, and he just froze. And all the rest of us, we crawled on, and we didn't see him. Then someone noticed he was gone, so I went back to find him, and he was still there, down on all fours, staring at that gravestone like it was trying to tell him something he didn't want to forget. I said, "Hey, Ezra. Hey. Hey." But he wasn't listening to me. He was listening to the stone. So I reached over, and I grabbed him, and I hauled him around in front of me so that I could get him going. And after a bit, I got him moving again. He was really young. He was younger than me. So we were crawling around the stones to join the others, and a shell landed right next to me. It shattered another gravestone, and there was rock everywhere. And I got some in my eyes, and I was coughing on dust, and for a second there I thought I was dead, but the shell didn't explode. Why? I don't know. I guess it was... He broke off, and she waited for him to continue. When he didn't, she helped him finish the story. It was because God saw that. He saw you helping that man. He said, I like that boy Henry, and I'm going to keep him safe. She laughed quietly and held him and kept laughing to herself until she fell asleep. And it was a playful laugh that bubbled up around them like a spring. Sometimes he thought it was actually the child laughing inside her, and he would fall asleep to that music. And some nights he would escape his dreams. Thank you. Thank you. I'm gonna play a song here real quick, and then invite my friend David Dye up here to rap a bit. All right.
inside the holy chapel made for Holy Grail, hiding the angel could be seen to smile to himself. The old great Sir Galahad from now on said, the angel, may all angels call me blessed of my race. Fear not the great Sir Galahad, I warn you, keep on riding. If you are, I pray you'll let me see your face. Galahad took off his helmet, said, good angel, look upon me. Fear not, for I bring tidings of great joy. For long years the grail you guarded, and you get to let me drink it. How happy must be angels thus employed. Oh, favors that you shower upon me, a simple angel, said the angel, your magnificence abounds. Take your boots off, great Sir Galahad, by your astounding beauty, whatever ground you stand on turns to holy ground. Galahad took off his boots, and he watched the ground quite closely, and the angel smiled to himself again. He said, I can't believe I'm asking, but Sir Galahad, please tell me, what is it that makes you want to go to heaven? In heaven there's no lamb chops, Queen Guinevere's, the hand jobs, marijuana, Kenny Rogers, or ecstasy. But in the glory, perhaps you've come by some mistake. To me, this seems more error than I err. Yes, and what about the stable boys? I know you think they're handsome, some of them, they think you're awful handsome too. And sitting up in heaven, you'll still think about them often when you're an angel, thinking it's all that you can do. At this, Sir Galahad got angry. Angel, he said, don't you tempt me, I wish to go to heaven and not to hell. So when women call me handsome, when the stable boys look lonesome, I'll hold my virtue very firmly by myself. I guarantee you'll hold it often. Better drink the wine, at least take your armor off. I gotta carry you to heaven, and despite what you'd imagine, I have trouble bearing heavy things aloft. Sir Galahad stood naked in a pile of his armor, his boots and helmet scattered all around. His perfect lips, they sipped the grail. His perfect heart commenced to fail. His perfect body fell upon the ground. The angel lit a cigarette, and when he was sure Galahad was dead, he picked all of his clothes up off the floor. Then I put on his boots and armor. I laid his body on the altar, put his helmet on, and I headed for the door.
Angels everywhere. So you ready to rap and relate? We are going to actually, in this case, I'm kind of like everybody in the audience because I know all your music and everybody, we're kind of on the same level talking about this this book. So there's going to be a chance for everybody to ask questions later. So I want to make sure people knew that. You know, this book is, I'm wondering, I don't know anything about the publishing business, but I know when you make a movie, you got to have an elevator pitch. You got to have something that, you know, you can say in a sentence that gets somebody to understand about a book. Do you have to do that in publishing? Did you have to, like, have a one-sentence thing? And if so, what would it have been for this book?
Well, yeah, I think it's useful to have that because, you know, it's nice to be able to say exact, you know, at least to be able to have a one-sentence lie. You know, so I said it was a talking horse and man escape a wildfire for a week. But then, you know, it's also, I would say it's about a guy who is home from the war, but not back from it. So
all of which is accurate. Whatever you do creatively, whether it's writing a song or this book, do you start with? Do you start with a character, or do you start with an idea you want to get across in what you're doing?
It was a character. It was this character of this guy, and it was actually, I tried writing a bunch of different things, and all I had was the look in his eye, which was a, and I didn't know what period he was in or what his situation was, but he had the look in his eye of somebody sitting at their table late at night doing a jigsaw puzzle by themselves, you know, that's like, you know, and just looking for some pattern. And no one will be there to appreciate it when he finds it or if he doesn't find it. It's just whatever it is his own kind of bewilderment, you know, which I can definitely relate to.
Well, that puzzle image is kind of important. How many people here have read Bright's Passage yet? A few of you. Wow, that's pretty good. You might still sell some books tonight. Because what you've done with this book is all the things you read are kind of from one strand of the story. Mm-hmm. And you managed to do this in a nonlinear fashion. When in the whole process did you come up with that decision? Because that seems pretty important.
Well, yeah, the story has three strands that are braided together. There's Henry Bright before the war, kind of growing up in flashes, and then the flashes of the war and his time in France during the First World War, and then what comes after in his time at home. And I was writing them, and I wrote them very as I needed to. You know, I wrote them in a linear way, but I was traveling and touring, and in my second or third draft, and really had this sense of discomfort with the straight ahead story, with the story starting early, and it felt like everything was leading up to a punchline, and I really didn't want that. I felt like it was a story being told all the way through, and I sat with it for a while. I was actually on tour. I was opening for the Swell Season all through Europe. We were traveling, and it was snow everywhere. And they had, for some reason, we had about 4 days in Vienna, and it was really cold, and there was a ton of snow. And I walked around, and I walked around and walked around and walked around, and then I was done with that. And and I went to this coffee shop and had this moment where I realized, and they've got great paper there, you know, the Austrians do incredible paper. You know, even the note cards, what you write down on them feels really like you've just done something, you know? you've really made a big contribution. And so I was I had this pack of note cards that I bought, and I had my draft, and I started writing down every scene on a separate note card. And I laid them out on the table and just tried to braid them together, you know? And that's kind of how it was really fun. It worked out better. I was happier that way.
Well, it gives you a number of different climaxes throughout the book, too, that way.
Yes.
You find out things from the different threads. It's really interesting. I want to talk about your process and all that, but I was kind of wondering, let's talk about that. Do you use the same discipline for songwriting? For instance, how would you write? Same time every day, same thing? And I'm also interested, do you listen to music while you're writing?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Like, well, it's so interesting with writing on the road. I consider like writing for songs to be collecting material. When I'm traveling, I can't think about the fact that I can't write. I can't say it like that because it just makes me sad. Yeah. And feel lazy if I can't write on the road, you know, because it's a big part of my life. But I now consider it collecting ideas, and it's time to read and you meet people and watch movies and listen to music. And that's great. With the book, what was great about it was that I could write on the road. I put on my headphones every day, and I thought about it like going to the beach. You know, you're just going to go to the beach for an hour, and then you come home. You know, you take off your headphones, and you've been to the beach, and you wrote 1,000 words, and that was important to me. Every day, it became a thing that I did, that I loved. So That was really great, and it was just felt like I was emptying something every day, and I listened to a couple things over and over again. I listened to Kid A, Radiohead's Kid A, which is just an amazing record to write to, I think, and then Aphex Twin. This he wrote this record called Drugs, D R U. KQS. It's all prepared piano stuff and really pretty. And then this guy Alfred Deller, who's a kind of a like a contratenor from the 1950s.
The Deller Consort.
Yeah.
Which, and that's, my parents had that record.
It's really floaty. All the music is really floaty and feels very scrubbed. And you don't have to, you know, there's nothing. The lyrics aren't dragging you into their world. They're kind of like opening it up for you. You know.
Josh created his own major at Oberlin, American History Through Narrative Folk Music. Wow, it looks like you actually got to use your college degree.
I did. Take that, Mom.
You talked about that one book, but there seems to be a lot of research that went into this. For instance, the World War One portion just seems particularly realistic. How would I know? But it just seems really grim and, mm-hmm. and really. There have been movies, but how did you research that?
Well, it definitely started with a few really important books, the Proud Tower, and then by Barbara Tuchman, and then our follow up, which was called The Guns of August, which are great overview histories, and another book called 11th Day, 11th Month, 11th Hour about the armistice. And taking the war from that angle, the First World War was so as a microcosm of the complete ridiculousness and absurdity of the First World War, when everybody decided they'd have enough fighting, they decided, well, we're gonna end the war on the 11th month, November, the 11th day at 11 in the morning, and it's over. And everybody decided, cool. But up until that moment, up until 11 in the morning, people were marching into machine guns and dying. And to me, that was one of the first facts I learned. And I thought that was just the most staggering thing. And from there, it kind of became a search for things that weren't absurd, you know? Like, a lot of the dry military histories are written with the lines on the maps and with the generals and with the leaders. But one of the great things about the First World War for somebody who's trying to learn more about it was that there's all these soldiers came home and wrote about it in a way that maybe there weren't a lot of people that could do that up until that point. And what they noticed were the little tiny things. You know, they noticed what the razor wire looked like, and they noticed that the fleas were everywhere, but not on chickens. You know, things that were really important, the real things. You know,
why West Virginia?
I actually wrote about West Virginia for two reasons. One was that in traveling through West Virginia, I've always loved it, and it's always seemed like a really mythic place. In America, and I wanted to. I always love it there. I've written songs there. I wrote. I was doing a show once with Joan Baez there, and when I was on one of my first tours around the States, and we stopped there for the night, and it was a Sunday, and I was like 23 or 24, and going to a liquor store was still pretty cool to me. And so I went out and I was looking for a liquor store, and none were open on Sundays. So I came back and I wrote the song Girl in the War there, and it was an important place for me. And also, I didn't want to set it in Idaho, you know, where I'm from. I wanted to make sure that there was, like, one thing I made sure was that I didn't want there to be music, and I didn't want there to be Idaho, because I wanted to be fully as far from autobiography as I could for this first thing.
Which brings me to an interesting question. One of the people who blurbed your book is Wesley Stace, John Wesley Harding. And I've talked about him a bit about the problem of being a songwriter and then being taken seriously as an author. And he says that's one of the reasons why he wrote under his real name and kept his John Wesley Harding for his music name. You've gotten pretty good reviews. It doesn't seem to be be a problem. Are you going to give it? What's your next work? Are you going to do another novel right away? Or
right now I want to work on some songs, and I'm reading a lot of for something else. Yeah, it just seems like you know there's just so little time to care about whether you're taken seriously or not. You know, mm-hmm. just to the writing is the most fun part. You know.
I always ask songwriters who they listen to, and I guess we need to know who you read.
There are so many incredible books that I would say, like, in a nod to Philadelphia, the autobiography of Benjamin Franklin is a badass book. Richard Feynman, this great physicist whose biographies are filled with everything but physics, you know? And that seems to be the same with Benjamin Franklin. He's too busy noticing details to really notice that you know, he helped create America. You know? but I would say that Pete Dexter, I'm a huge fan of him. I think his books, Paperboy, and God's Pocket, you know, is one of my favorite books. And Muriel Spark, a Scottish writer who wrote really short books about that were just completely immoral and really funny. And Flannery O'Connor in that same way, you know, I love her. I also love The Ghost Writer by Philip Roth is one of my favorites, you know. I just like a lot of stuff.
Clearly.
Yeah.
And the Deller concert. Now, how does being on an author tour compare to being on a rock tour?
There's people tend to have nicer pens on book situation. Let's see, the hotels are nicer. Definitely, I took a shower last night in a very uncomfortable place. And today the hotel's really nice.
So there you go.
I was somewhere else on music tour. And then I'd say, but the number of sandwiches are the same.
Sandwiches. Flat meat.
Them. Yeah, yeah.
Well, here's a little exercise. There's a couple of your songs that, to me, that kind of could become, you know, something bigger. One of them is the one with the folks in the silo, The Temptation of Adam.
Yeah.
I'll put you on the spot. How would you expand that? Would you give them a backstory?
I'd say, like, you know, I was talking with somebody the other day about how we could unfold, try and take Jack and Diane, and how you would build their backstory. Like, they met at Camp Mellencamp in like the fifth grade, and moved forward to the Tasty Freeze part, which everybody likes. But I would say with the missile silo, there's this. It could be great, you know. She could be from the Bronx. And he would be from North Dakota, and they'd both be out in South Dakota, and he'd pretend like he knew what was going on. But, you know, she would really be the ball buster. And, I'm not sure.
And unfortunately, you kind of know how that one ends with the apocalypse. But now the Currents, I almost can't ask the question, because you really do have pretty much the full story in there with the archaeologist and the mummy. What were you reading that inspired that book, that song?
Well, I ran across a thing I had just moved to New York, and one of the few places that I really knew about, being from a small town and being taught by my parents, you know, when you go to a big city, go to the museum, you know, that's what you do, you know, and they taught me well, so I still feel. I still go to the museum, even though I live there. I go there all the time, and the first thing I saw was the Egyptian room, you know. And then and then there in the beautiful Brooklyn Public Library, I was reading about the Egyptians and their burial techniques, and the idea that the pyramid looked like the crystallized rays of the sun, and it was a technology, and it was all a technology to, like, elevate this person, soul. to wherever it needed to go. And I really thought that that was beautiful. So I, lying there in bed, I just sometimes would just pretend that I was a mummy. You know, that kind of feeling. Sometimes you feel like that, you know, wrapped up.
So your parents encouraged you to go to museums. They were both scientists, or were they either of them? Were they writers?
They're both scientific writers, and they really taught me. I remember, you know, coming home, fifth grade, sixth grade, with my papers that I was supposed to be writing, you know, and my dad just having the red pen. You know, and it was just infuriating, you know, and he is such an amazing writer and a thinker, and as a scientist, they're both just truly tremendous. But they have always instilled in like my brother and I that the idea of good writing is concision, no matter what you're writing, you know, whether it's a song or a novel or a paper. You know, a scientific paper, say as much as you can with as few words. You know, and I always think that my ideas of songs as things that can be unfolded or worlds that you only see dimly are just because you're trying to say as few things as possible, as much as possible with as few words. You know.
Well, it's interesting to hear you talk about how you would write. You do, you know, 1,000 words in an hour or whatever much time it might be, because you read this book and there must have been a lot of editing involved, because it is so concise. The sentences sing in a lot of ways, and so it went through a number of edits.
Yeah, I did.
How do you respond to that?
It was great. I mean, the editing on the most part was self-inflicted. You know, I know of writers who write, and when they finish, it's done. You know, and with me, I wrote the first draft in 2 months, and then over the next year, I went through about 12 more drafts. And I started to think of it more as a process of trying not to annoy myself. You know, I've never been so fully embarrassed as, like, I think, as sitting in the room by myself reading back stuff that I'd written, you know. And a lot of times it was that you would write and write and write, and there would be whole sections and whole characters whose lives were so much larger that I then cut away and was really happy about. But the only way for me to continue moving forward and not edit myself as I was going along was to set myself a word count, you know, and make sure that I hit that and know that when the book was done, it was going to be done, but it wouldn't be for a long time. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. A lot of that editing process goes on with all of us. I mean, a lot of things we do. I'm going to throw it open to people, because I know you guys are easily as big fans of Josh as I am, so there must be some good questions here. Right. And let's start. I'll just point to people. Go ahead.
Awesome.
Hi. I have two questions for you. First of all, I'm a huge fan of yours, as everybody is here.
Thanks.
So I read Bright's passage, and I loved it. And one of the reasons that I loved it is because it sounded like your music. And nice. I'm curious if you had the same reaction when you finished it. You said, okay, this sounds like me. And the second part of that is, I've seen you twice in concert, and it's so obvious how much you appreciate your audience. And I was curious if you were aware of how much they appreciate you.
Well, thank you very much. In terms of the writing, yeah, I think I had something lucky. Luckily, like starting with, you know, I put out my first record in 1999, and I think over time I've been very lucky to have a career that has gone in a way that I've been able to develop my voice slowly, you know, and not have it become set early on. And I hopefully that means that it continues to grow and develop in different ways. But so that when I got to the point of writing this book, luckily I had a voice that I felt comfortable in. And it's definitely, you know, it's apart from music, it's apart from anything. I think it's mostly just the confidence in what you have to say in a certain way. But then also just reading it aloud really helped me. You know, everybody says that you should read what you write aloud, and that good writing should be able to be read fairly easily aloud. And I totally agree with that. I think that there's that switch in there. It definitely feels that way with songs for me. Does that make sense? Okay.
You've also developed different voices for different characters too. I saw an early reading on YouTube, and you've definitely.
Yeah, it's fun. Yeah, I love it.
You're an actor now as well. We'll move up, gentleman here.
Howdy.
Hey, Josh. Thanks for being here tonight.
Thank you.
I'm just curious about your use of your horses. It seems to be something that's in your albums and clearly in this book. What's with horses?
Yeah. My dad was trained as a veterinarian, you know, and he still teaches veterinary students, and my brother and I were always around them, you know, but sort of on the edges, and a lot of the stories, you know, would be a lot of the people that were around. Idaho is a big horse area, you know, lots of horses mostly, but you know, in general, I've always, they're the biggest thing, you know, they're the biggest thing around. You know, it's sort of like standing next to a huge tree, you know, like you feel like it must be thinking a lot more than maybe it is, you know what I mean? That feeling of something bigger and stronger and wiser than you are, you know, whether horses are that or not, it always is stuck in my head. And then one time I had a really amazing moment that has always stuck with me. I was driving late at night. I was driving up into the mountains, in the Cascade Mountains in western Washington, and I was on my way to go someplace, and I was going to work on my record, Animal Years, for a while. And it was late at night in the wintertime, but it was still sort of warm, and there was this fog that was lifting off the ground. I was on a very narrow road, and I was almost to where I'd have been. It was a long drive, and I came around a corner, and there was a horse just standing there in the middle of the road. And I'm not a fast driver, but I was driving fast enough that I almost hit it. And it just stood there and looked at me. And I've always thought about it. It felt like a big moment in my life. And I for some reason, I've always cared about horses more since that.
Did it speak?
I did.
Let's go over here.
Yes. This is going to be a pretty random question. Yeah. I walked by you and written out swear today. What were you eating for dinner?
Wow.
And would I have been an ass if I would have been like, oh my God, you're Josh Ritter?
No. I think I had some, it was bread with some tomatoes, and it was delicious. That's a beautiful square. I want to change my name to Rittenhouse. Yeah, beautiful. Yeah.
Thank you.
Hi.
This question hinges on a little bit of an assumption, so send me packing if it doesn't make any sense. I guess the assumption is that you seem to really cull a lot of your material from observation in life. Like, you strike me as someone who was a watcher before you had output, because
yeah,
there's so much substance. And I just can't help but wonder that as you gain these accolades, is it harder to find material now that your life is more affected?
Well, I think that you spend a lot of time just sort of watching when you're I think everybody when they're a kid is trying to learn something, and at a certain point you either feel like you've got all the answers or you don't, and I'm not saying that that's an assumption you can really come to. It's just I think that writing is mostly about pouring stuff in, you know. And on occasion you get a little bit back, you know, like the lucky thing, you know. So that and as things get busy and things get more complicated and your family life changes and all sorts of things happen, The difficult part is to keep on continuing to pour stuff in, you know, and to stay open and to, like, continue reading and to continue listening, to continue being, like, astounded by other things. And that's the hardest part. I think that the writing is just recombination, you know. It's just stuff getting mixed around in there, you know, and coming out in a slightly different way. You know, what happens when you mix, you know, chocolate sauce and spaghetti? You know, something cool will happen, I think, hopefully. But just try to stay open to it. Yeah. But I think that's always the problem, you know, just, and I think it happens to anybody, you know. Bills come, you get Social Security numbers, and you get, you know, you have to try and remember your credit card number and your password, which was, there's so many passwords. Like, how do we continue to think just normal person thoughts, you know? Yeah. Yeah.
Over here.
I was wondering how you found the difference and similarities between the business of music and the business of publishing.
Wow, that's a good question. I think that I'm fairly new to publishing, and someone has likened it to jumping from iceberg to iceberg. You know, my friend has a T-shirt that says, you know, music business in recession since 1994. You know, and but I've grown up in a music business where, you know, in a lot of ways I was really lucky because I didn't see, I was not brought up in the idea of selling, you know, a million records or even 100,000 records. It took me 4 years to sell my first 1,000 records, but it was about, you know, you work and you do what you do, and you we live in a time now which is coming back to the era when artists did what they did to live, you know, and to survive and not to you know, buy Learjets, you know. And so I think with the book world, it's, you know, there are still luckily people buying books, you know. The way we buy books is definitely changing, but I've been really amazed and heartened in the same way that it's great to hear people listening to new music all the time, that it's great that there are people that are reading books. And it's nice to, like, know that you're not the only one, you know, and that there are people out there. Yeah. I walked into a place recently when my book was had just gotten the actual book, and there was a bunch of people meeting to talk about, you know, book business stuff, and I got invited, and I went in, and there was indie booksellers from all over the country, you know, and they were just rockers. You know, I just didn't know that they were out there, you know, but they were just rock and rollers, you know. It was cool. Does that kind of answer it? Okay, yeah.
Let's take a couple. If there's anybody in the back that we haven't done yet, maybe we'll. This gentleman, I guess, in the middle.
Thank you for sharing your work with us tonight. This is great.
Thank you.
A lot of your stories are very sad. Whether it's, you know, your book or a lot of your songs.
Yeah. This,
even the more upbeat ones have an underlying sadness to them. And I was wondering, for you, what is it about sadness that makes such a beautiful story?
Wow. Well, I think, you know, hopefully with every, you know, with every great amount of sadness, there's an equal amount of levity in there. I've never ever trusted or gotten much out of something that is unrelentingly dark. I think that's really easy. You know, it's easy to say how screwed up things are. It's also really easy to go the other direction and completely deny, you know, any sadness. I think that's also easy, and you know, anybody that watches, you know Leno can tell you that, like, you know, that there's the, you can't, you know, a monologue with a touch of tragedy in there would be something amazing to see, wouldn't it? If there was just a total breakdown for a second. you know. But I never really got the idea that tragedy was ever fully tragic. You know, there's comedy sometimes in how screwed up stuff can be, and the idea of the snake eating its tail and that tragedy turns into a comedy at a certain point, and the other direction is really vital, I think, to anything that really feels like it has some staying power to me. I mean, for one of the reasons I love Laurel and Hardy, or Buster Keaton, is that nothing gets done, you know, and screw ups are abounding, but somehow they're muddling through, and so it's tragic at the same time as it's funny, or even a lightweight like Shakespeare, and with King Lear and there's this moment where Gloucester's eyes have been put out, and he says, "My life is over." And he gets this guy to lead him to the cliffs. He's like, "Send me the cliffs so that I can jump over and end it all." And he has no eyes, so when the guy leads him to the edge of to the ground, there's no cliffs, and describes him the cliffs, he throws himself off and just lands on the ground. and it's horrifying, you know, this man whose eyes have just been pulled out, and he's lying there on the ground, but it's also kind of funny, you know, like it is still funny. So I think there can be, hopefully there's always a mixture of those two things, you know? Yeah.
It's interesting to hear you say that, because I've heard you describe Bright's Passage as a comedy, and yet Henry's life is pretty grim, no matter where he is.
Yeah, yeah.
So you definitely put that in there. Not that you shouldn't read it, you know. It's someone else in the back there.
Yes.
Hold on, wait for the mic.
Thank you.
I just wanted to ask you about when you're writing prose, is there someone, living, dead, real or unreal, that you're writing to? And is it the same person or same thing for music?
Somebody kind of like a touchstone?
An audience or an inspiration or a muse?
I think mostly it's just there should always be in whatever you do something that is the spark of yourself. And whatever it is, it's kind of undefinable. And I feel like if you're unlucky enough to figure out exactly what that is, then you're in trouble, because you think then you've got it, you know, and you can just kind of replicate it. But really, I think it's mostly just, you know, just trying to entertain yourself, you know, trying to entertain yourself. That's rather than anybody else, you know. Just hopefully, if you write about it and you're happy with it, then other folks will be able to understand it. I mean, I can't imagine that Mark Twain was really writing about it to entertain, you know, initially anybody but himself when he was writing, you know, some of those books. Because I'm not sure if that's true or not, but I like to think so. And yeah.
Let's do one more. Not over here.
Hey, Josh, how are you?
Good, how are you doing?
I find myself listening to a lot of your music when I'm traveling, and it tends to bring up ideas for me of place and being at home. Mm-hmm. I fell in love with The Animal Years, and especially the songs like Idaho, where I'm thinking about what it means to be on the road. And it always really, I feel like your storytelling always has a really great sense of place. And I was wondering if that comes from being a nomadic soul or being someone who's really rooted, or whether that's just something that I just implied on my own. I feel like that's such a strong piece of your storytelling for me.
Wow, that's cool. You know, I grew, yeah, I mean, I I'm from Idaho, and I have not lived there in several years, but I always thought that Idaho was my you know, if that got swept away, I don't know where I would be from. You know, the last 10 years have been mostly lived in a whole bunch of different places from day to day, and I think that there's part of that, you know, that is exciting, but also a part that you know, I have to come to terms with. You know, I have to, you know, I love. I remember first starting out on the road, and I came across two books that were really important. One was the autobiography of Johnny Cash, which was great, and I loved because it was about an entire life lived kind of on the road, and the other was and how much joy he took in that, and how much he became he found a place for himself in America rather than in one place, not because he was bigger than one place, but because that's what he had, you know. And you know, and then the other was a book called Blue Highways by William Least Heat Moon, which was a beautiful book about traveling around America on the non-interstates and just using the blue highways and going all the way around in the same way, because in a, you know, because he had lost his job and because there were things in his life that were falling apart, and all he had was place, and so he was just going and trying to describe it and find some comfort in America as a huge place, and we're really lucky to be able to do that, you know, to be able to be Americans and living in this enormous big country that we can kind of get lost in if we want to. We always talk about it on the road, like there's certain cities where, you know, the band and I say, you know, well, if ever anything like seriously hit the skids, I could get lost in this town for a while, you know, and I like that. So place is really important to me, yeah. Try to do it justice.
So do we have time for maybe another song?
Sure, yeah.
No. Nice.
Yay!
I just want to thank David Dye. He's been an amazing champion.
Josh Ritter, singer, songwriter, author, traveler. And book signer. That's his next occupation, which will take place upstairs. Josh, thank you so much. That was great.
Thanks a lot. Thanks a lot.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.